The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod then did not officially speak to this whole question of relationship to the American Lutheran Church either in 1973 or 1975. Although resolutions had been prepared, we were so occupied with our own internal problems and questions at these conventions that these resolutions never came to the convention's floor. Whenever the Synod next addressed itself to this question in 1977, it adopted a resolution that said basically three things. It said that on the one hand, repeated discussions with the American Lutheran Church had indicated that there were doctrinal differences that existed at the church body level between our two synods that were divisive of pulpit and altar fellowship, and that if not corrected, they would ultimately lead to the cessation of altar and pulpit fellowship. Differences in the understanding of Scripture, in the understanding of fellowship, the ordination of women, and such questions as these. But it also stated that there was some indication that there was confusion in our own circles regarding what we meant by fellowship, and that therefore we would take two actions at this convention. On the one hand, we would ask the CTCR to do a major study on the nature and implications of the concept of fellowship, and that secondly, we would enter into what we call a state of fellowship in protest, and that we would reassess our relationship to the American Lutheran Church at the 1979 convention of the Synod. The commission immediately went to work on this question. Some 50 conferences were held discussing the matter of concord in the church throughout the Synod. And the CTCR in these conferences became convinced that it was necessary that our Synod involve itself in a very fundamental and basic study of what the Scriptures had to say about fellowship. And so we decided rather than to complete our report, we would prepare this Bible study and come to the 79 convention asking that the Synod involve itself in this study and that it not take up the matter of its relationship to the American Lutheran Church, but rather simply put this question off 2 years and continue our state of fellowship in protest with the American Lutheran Church. This recommendation of the commission was accepted in 1979. The Synod resolved that the Synod be encouraged to participate in the Bible study on fellowship. It added the provision that the Commission on Fellowship should prepare a clear and documented statement of the doctrinal differences with the American Lutheran Church. And then it resolved that the CTCR should complete its report on the nature and implications of the concept of fellowship. These three documents have been completed during the past 2 years. The Commission has completed its two, the Bible study on fellowship and the report on the nature and implications of fellowship. And the Commission on Fellowship has finished its report on the doctrinal differences that exists between the two synods. It's on the basis of these documents, then, that have been shared throughout the synod that the commission has prepared its recommendation with respect to future relationships with the American Lutheran Church. And as we went to formulate our recommendation in accordance with the mandate that is ours in the Constitution and bylaws of the Church, namely that our commission is to be responsible for providing guidance to the synod in matters of theology and church relations, we have recommended that we declare at this convention that the Missouri Synod is no longer in altar and pulpit fellowship with the American Lutheran Church. When we made this recommendation, we did so on the basis of three basic facts. On the one hand, we did so on the basis of the report on the Commission on Fellowship, this document here, which many of you have seen, a statement of doctrinal differences that was prepared and distributed by the Commission on Fellowship, that both the American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod recognize that there are fundamental doctrinal differences between our two churches at the church body level. I think this is substantiated whenever I can point out that whenever this document was shared with the American Lutheran Church representatives, the officials of the American Lutheran Church stated to us, yes, this is a clear, a fair, objective statement of the relationships and the positions of our two church bodies. In fact, Dr. David Preuss ordered 6,000 copies of this document so it could be shared with the pastors of his synod. Secondly, the church bodies have not been successful in our discussions during the past 12 years and the intensive discussions in the last 4 years in resolving these differences. Differences that center on the understanding of the nature and authority of Scripture, the meaning of confessional subscription, and the understanding of the basis for fellowship itself. And thirdly, the third fact that we had to take into account was that for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, these differences are divisive of altar and pulpit fellowship according to our traditional understanding of what this relationship is. And herein lies really one of the underlying basic differences between our two church bodies. For although the American Lutheran Church recognizes that these differences exist, they do not believe that they should be divisive of altar and pulpit fellowship. In fact, the same officials that said this is a fair statement of our position said it makes the strongest argument yet why our two church bodies should remain in altar and pulpit fellowship. So these are the facts that the commission had to work with. And we felt that we had then to make a decision according to our responsibilities, a recommendation regarding future relationships to the American Lutheran Church. And we saw that our Synod was basically faced with three fundamental options. On the one hand, we could recommend that our Synod change its understanding of the meaning of altar and pulpit fellowship. Our report on the nature and implications of the concept of fellowship indicated that such a change was not warranted, that our traditional understanding of what was necessary for this kind of relationship is in fact supported by the scriptures and the Lutheran confessions. A second option would have been for the commission to recommend that we continue the state of fellowship in protest. And in fact, this is the recommendation we followed in 1979. However, we felt that the report of the Commission on Fellowship indicated that the differences between our two church bodies were very clearly established, that it would not be correct for us to come to the Synod and say that there was hope that two more years of discussion would perhaps lead us to a closer agreement with the American Lutheran Church. In fact, the final meeting that the Commission on Fellowship held with the American Lutheran Church, both sides said, "We understand what you're saying. We're more firm than ever in our understanding and our position regarding the authority of Scripture, confessional Scripture, and fellowship. We do not believe that we can in good conscience hold out the hope that two more years of discussions with the American Lutheran Church will resolve the differences that exist between us." There have been those who have suggested, well, why don't we just hold off on this fellowship question and let the merger that is being discussed between the ALC, LCA, and AELC solve our problem for us. Because if these three church bodies merge into one Lutheran church, then we're automatically out of fellowship with the American Lutheran Church. This did not seem to the commission to be a fair and honest and helpful way to proceed. If we really believe that the differences that exist between us are divisive of fellowship, then we should not play politics with this kind of a question. The third option is to recommend that fellowship be terminated, pulpit and altar fellowship, with the American Lutheran Church. And this is, in fact, the recommendation that the commission has made, and I should tell you that we have done that with great reluctance and only after much thought and deliberation. Our commission has been called a group of ivory tower hair splitters, but I wish you could see the commission that we work with. We've got eight professors. Maybe you could call them a little bit of a ivory tower hair splitter. You know your president here and Roland Hauptmann over there. We have seven pastors, parish pastors, on the commission. Six laymen, two teachers. One of the members of the commission himself is being served by a congregation that has a retired ALC pastor serving as the assistant pastor. We know the sensitiveness of the questions involved in our relationship to the American Lutheran Church. And we feel that it's imperative that we go about discussing this question responsibly. And that's why the commission didn't just simply recommend that we break altar and pulpit fellowship with the American Lutheran Church. Rather, we made a number of recommendations to the Synod. Not only that we honestly say we don't have what it takes for altar and pulpit fellowship, but that we also assure these other church bodies of our intent and desire to relate to them in a patient and evangelical way. We asked President Preuss to appoint a committee to draw up guidelines that would be helpful to the Synod, assuming that we would, if the convention should decide to break fellowship, how this could be done in an evangelical way. This committee has met last week, and it's going to meet again in a couple of weeks. We furthermore recommend that we tell the Synod that the Synod tell the other churches that we want to continue intensive discussions with the American Lutherans, and indeed with all other Lutherans, so that we might overcome the differences that exist between us. We recommend that we continue to relate in a pastoral way to individual members of the American Lutheran Church. One of the fears, I think, in the Synod concerns the relationships at the local level. I know since our recommendation has come out, I've had a number of telephone calls. One from a young lady here in St. Louis who said, "My father is a pastor in the ALC. And I've moved to St. Louis, I married a member of the Missouri Synod, I've joined the Missouri Synod. If fellowship is broken this summer, whenever I go to see my father, can I go to communion in his church?" These are the kinds of questions that disturb people. This is why the commission has felt that we needed to emphasize and repeat that we have always attempted to be pastoral in our ministry to individual people and encourage our pastors to continue to do that in the future. Finally, we're asking that the Synod resolve itself to continue its study of fellowship in the future, especially how we might carry out our relationships with other Christians with whom we are not in altar and pulpit fellowship, so that we might have, as it were, kind of levels of relationship that correspond to our levels of agreement. And this is the thought that I would leave with you as I conclude this update and explanation of the CTCR's recommendation, that I hope that as people come to the convention to discuss this sensitive matter, they will look upon this recommendation of the CTCR and give it careful consideration. We need to have that kind of exchange. I welcome your comments here tonight. But I hope that people will see it as one of the members of this committee that's working on the guidelines said at our meeting last Monday, "You know, after hearing you talk, this is kind of an exciting recommendation of the CTCR. For rather than destroying a relationship with the American Lutheran Church, it really is simply recognizing the reality of the situation, and it is opening up a whole new avenue of relationships with other churches, like the Lutheran Church in America, and other churches with whom we have various degrees of relationship and agreement in doctrine." I would simply conclude by saying that I pray that the Lord will guide our church as we continue to wrestle with this question, that he will give our four committees and our delegates the wisdom to give this matter careful consideration and to take that action which is pleasing to God and in accordance with our own doctrinal position and our understanding of what the Scriptures had to say about fellowship. Thank you very much.
I don't think I have to remind you of what the situation at Concordia Seminary was some 7 or 8 years ago and how we had only a handful of students left after the walkout. I think that God has blessed our seminary tremendously. In fact, it is to me a miracle of what has really happened in these years. We also know that God works through people. If we were to single out any one individual that has been a tremendous blessing to our institution is certainly Dr. Bowman, who serves as the president, who is going to bring us a little update on the seminary. But to share with you, I'm sitting beside Mrs. Bowman here tonight. She was telling me of something of a little embarrassment that she had the other day when she was at one of the department stores, so that her husband very seldom will take the time to go out shopping for himself. So she went down and she went into the men's department and she said to the gal, "I'm looking for something wild and youthful in men's slacks." And the girl said, "Aren't we all, dearie, aren't we all?" Dr. Bowman, if you will.
You forgot to say that Pat has found that. At least the youthful part. Yeah. Well, you are a most patient audience, as usual. It's always good to get together with you again, and when Manny reminisces about 1974 and all of the wonderful things that have happened since then, it's good for us all to remember tonight that you've been together with us since 1974, at least. And when you think back to those grim and dark days when we were so very small and wondered whether we would ever be able to survive, let alone begin to produce the number of pastors needed by the church. It was you who came together and said, carry on, the Lord is in his heavens, let's trust him and he'll do what is necessary at the seminary. And my goodness, he certainly has and he continues to. The update that I'm bringing you tonight is going to be very brief because you've seen many of the colleagues, the faculty and administration colleagues here tonight tell you about some of the things happening, so I shan't have to do that. Let me say a few words about some of the people who are on the program and tell you just a little bit about a few things that they did not mention. First of all, this has always been an interesting group, I must say. When I was over in the Pritzlaff Lounge before dinner having a glass of wine with you, someone gave me a gift that you'd made especially for, yeah, you. And I don't know if you can see it or not. It's a washer with a 22 shell and 3 pennies. And this was given to me, and I knew we were hard up for money, but I didn't think that Manny and Roger were out asking for pennies. But I was told that this was actually a quarter. It's a Polish quarter. 22, 23, 24, 25. And the man who gave us this wonderful gift with its unique ethnic dimension should stand and be recognized. Come on now, come on, fess up. Then the next nice thing that happened was when Pat and I got in here and discovered that after 7 years of trying to avoid sitting at a head table, we have finally succeeded, and that's really an accomplishment. We're still close, and I was explaining to the folks sitting across from us how much we enjoyed sitting out in the audience instead of up at the head table. Mrs. Jekyll said, yeah, there's no head table. The seminary's all mixed up tonight. I began to wonder, maybe I ought to get back to the head table where people didn't accuse us of being mixed up. But I want to thank you for limiting it to tonight and for recognizing that we're not always all that mixed up. The Dean Hempelman telling us the good news about enrollment, told us about that church where people have all these strange speech habits and all. You know, you forgot the punchline on that one, Dean. The lady who walked out and told the pastor he preached such a wonderful sermon and that she thought it ought to be published posthumously. Remember that one? But it's good to hear our serious professors tell us about all the great things that are happening here. The people on our program, I think, are just a sample of some of the wonderful people that God has brought together at Concordia Seminary to do the job he's given us to do. I particularly thank my good friend Sam Nasker for taking time from his busy schedule with the Commission on Theology, not only to bring us an update on a difficult subject, and I think many of you will want to ask some questions about that, but also for taking time from his schedule to teach a course for us each year. At least we've had Sam out for the last 2 years, and he's teaching again this summer. It's an indication of the kind of solid fare that we are trying to provide for our young men who are about to go out in the church and serve as pastors. The ALC Fellowship subject, I might just make one announcement on that. I believe it's next Wednesday, if I remember correctly, that the seminary is hosting a dialogue or discussion on the subject of fellowship with the American Lutheran Church that some of you might be interested in attending if you're not tied up in the office or at home. We have invited the president of the ALC's Wartburg Seminary to be a part of a discussion presenting from the American Lutheran Church's point of view why that church body feels we should remain in fellowship. Dr. Nasker will be presenting the resolution of the Commission on Theology that you heard this evening, trying to explain to the students why the Commission feels that fellowship is a very difficult thing for us to continue. And I will be serving as the moderator of the discussion. Both Bill Weiblin and Sam Nasker and I are members of the Commission on Fellowship. I guess Bill Weiblin and I are probably the senior members on it. We've been on it since 1969. We hope that many of you can come. 10 a.m. next Wednesday, and I imagine we'll be doing this in the chapel. No? Seek Hall. Okay. It'll have to be a bigger room than the one we normally use for this, I'm sure. Seek Hall is the building right across from the chapel, and if you can come, I think from 10 to probably 11:30 or so, we'd love to have you tune in on that discussion. The reason, of course, for bringing in a spokesman from the American Lutheran Church is that we believe, as I think you know us real well by now, we believe in having our students hear both sides of issues, and we believe in having both sides of issues presented in a fair, honest, objective, clear way. There is far too much caricaturing going on of other people's points of view in the world today and in the church too. And we felt that by having the best spokesman for two points of view present to our students, we would have a fair and hopefully a helpful presentation of a very difficult and sensitive issue. The update on the seminary has pretty much been given in terms of continuing goodness of God. The fund drive was successful. Buildings are being renovated. Bills are being paid. I don't need to repeat that. The enrollment for next year looks unbelievably good. For I don't know what that will be now, the eighth year in a row, it will go up. And that is good indeed. I think the mood at the seminary, if I would make any comment at all, by way of a look to the future, the mood at the seminary among the staff today is a mixture of optimism and confusion, of hesitancy. The optimism, I think you can understand. I hope you can understand why also the second part of it might be true. Like many other institutions in the Synod, we're all waiting to find out what's going to happen at our synodical convention this summer, because we recognize that the change of leadership that will occur at that time will have a very profound effect upon this seminary. And that's true not only because I have been honored by the church as one of the candidates for the synodical presidency, but even if the other men are elected president, which sometimes I hope happens, and I certainly hope that God makes it clear to the church whom he wants, but it seems to me that the question of who is elected synodical president is in a sense irrelevant to the observation that life at an institution like this one will change with the change in synodical leadership that will occur next summer. And we're finding that as we try to attract new staff people to the seminary, new professors, new administrators, that a lot of people are kind of wondering who will be the president of the synod, what will the convention do in its constitutional changes that are being considered, what will the funding future of the seminary be. There's an interesting proposal before the synod that the synod take over 100% funding of the seminary. And what does that mean for us? So we're all looking forward to the end of the convention, I think in many respects, so that humanly speaking, we can begin to make our plans with a little bit more definiteness than we are able to do now. But I dare say that one thing will be true regardless of what happens at the convention. Perhaps I should say two things, because the second is dependent upon this one, and that is that the Lord of the church will remain its Lord. Its leadership is in him, and that will be secure. It will not only be a leadership of the church that is direct, but a leadership that is strong, and above all, a leadership that is gracious. We can be sure of that. And I think that in all of the confusion and uncertainty that we, and you, I should think, feel about the future direction of the church, we are all agreed that it's in the hands of the Lord, and that is good news. And then the second observation is, as I said, dependent upon that one. That precisely because of the goodness of the Lord of the church and his continuing leadership, I believe very, very strongly that Concordia Seminary will be playing an increasingly strong role in the life of this church body. We have had to concentrate for the last years simply on rebuilding the seminary, on staffing it, putting it on a firm financial foundation, attracting students. But the time is obviously here in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod for a strong and God-centered, Christ-centered institution like this one to exert the kind of pastoral and theological and spiritual leadership that I believe our church is very, very hungry for. If the present success of the Synod's major funding effort, the Forward in Remembrance Drive, which I am told is now over $60 million in pledges and receipts, if that tells us anything, it seems to me to be saying that the people of this church want to go forward in missions and in the training of pastors and missionaries. We are tired of constantly fighting and warring with each other. We're tired of being a negative, backward-looking people. God has given us strength, He has given us leadership, and above all, He has given us a theology with which to run and not merely to stand. And I rather imagine that regardless of the human leadership that God gives this great church body, this seminary, with its firm stand upon the Word of God and the heritage of Lutheranism, but with its equally strong concern for people and its passion for souls, its desire to be sensitive and patient and gentle and progressive, will be a voice that is strongly needed in the future years of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And I know that the men and the women of Concordia Seminary, not only those splendid young men who keep coming in record numbers, but these wonderful professors who teach them and the administrators who help make the place run, and especially you and the hundreds of thousands of laity and pastors throughout this church like you, that with people like this working together under the great Lord of this church, Concordia Seminary's future, I firmly believe, is going to be even more meaningful for this church body in the future than it has in the past. And that's good news, I should think, for all of us and for all of you. Well, you've been patient. Manny, do you want to move right into questions, and or how do you want to move? You want to give people a chance to stand up and take a seventh inning stretch? We'll do that in just 1 minute. Let me introduce what we're going to do right after. If any of you are here for the first time, this will be news, but for you old-timers, you know that we've always had questions and answers about anything from soup to nuts. If you can relate it somehow to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod or Concordia Seminary, that's always nice. But this has always been a place where the laity of Greater St. Louis area could come and ask questions or make comments and be heard and get an answer. So why don't we stretch, and then when you sit back down, you can ask questions to Dr. Nasker or me, or if they really get tough, we'll ask Roger or Manny to answer them. So why don't we take a little stretch, and then we'll have some questions. I want to introduce two of our new staff members who are here this evening. I think many of you who have followed the Concordia Seminary over the years grew to know Coach Eldon Peterson quite well. He retired last year after being our athletic director and coach for 30 years. And we wondered who in the world might replace him and give the kind of Christian leadership in our athletic program and our recreational activities that Pete had done. I must say again, the Lord answered our prayers and sent us a really wonderful man and family. And I'd like to introduce at this time Coach and Mrs. Tom Nansen. Tom is our athletic director and our assistant dean of students. Tom, nice to have you here. And one of our newest professors, a professor of New Testament theology, a graduate of this institution who did a good deal of his doctoral study in Germany, and then came to the seminary to complete his doctoral study, has been serving as what we call a Walter Fellow, that is the recipient of perhaps our most distinguished scholarship for the last year or so, and this year has begun to help us a little in the classroom, was recently called to the seminary, and will serve beginning next year as assistant professor of New Testament. In a few weeks, he's going to receive his doctor's degree. Pastor and Mrs. Jonathan Grothy over here to my right. Nice to have you aboard. Some of you may have met Jonathan's father, Frederick, who is retired and is actually, I don't know if this is the first father-son combination we've had or not, but Fred Grothy is also doing some teaching for us in Old Testament. So father takes the old and son takes the new. Now we need another generation of Grothys to cover the intertestamental period, I think. Okay, let's look at some of the questions you've handed in. Let me take the written ones, and then we'll see whether we can field some others here. This one is for me, and I have to unfold them here. Dr. Bowman, do you expect the ALC, LCA, and AELC to merge in the near future? The common speculation among the pastors of most churches is that there will be some kind of organizational merger or union of these three church bodies. But there is a growing amount of disagreement within those church bodies about the shape that such an organizational merger might take. The leadership of those churches some years ago has made four proposals that the districts and synods of those other church bodies have been discussing and will be discussing during the coming months, whether to, for example, to form one huge church body, or whether to form a number of regionally merged church bodies, or whether to keep the church bodies distinct but to merge their program operations, that is to say, to do their mission work together or their parish education together. And they're discussing these things these days. It's interesting to observe that in the LCA, for example, the general trend has been toward merger. But in the American Lutheran Church, there is a division of opinion on it, with the president of the American Lutheran Church, Dr. David Preuss, having come out very publicly recently in saying that merger should not occur. He does not favor it. He feels that they can work together just as well without it. And he, in turn, has been greeted by an almost unanimous opposition on the part of, guess who? The seminary professors of the ALC and LCA and AELC. So there is a real difference of opinion within ALC on this question, and I believe a bit of a growing difference of opinion within the LCA too. The one group that seems to be completely sure that there should be a merger is the AELC, the splinter group that left the Missouri Synod some time ago. I do not predict, if we're going to play the role of prophet, I do not predict a merger within the next 3 or 4 years the way some do. It may not even happen in our lifetime, because I believe that struggle is pretty intense. It is likely, however, to see some change in the shape of American Lutheranism in the 1980s. And one reason why the Missouri Synod, I do believe, needs to be very, very careful about its church relations decisions and its leadership in this area as it moves into the 80s. Here's another one. If you are elected Missouri Synod president, that's what I like about this group, you come right to the point. What will be your position in dealing with the district presidents and pastors who now are conducting and allowing services, etc., with churches in which we are not in agreement, AELC, ALC, LCA, etc.? First of all, I am not sure that I'm in a position to accept the question at face value, which is to say that there are district presidents who are conducting and allowing services. There are probably some allowing. I am not sure that some are conducting. And the reason that sounds ambiguous, it's because I'm simply not a party to the actual goings-on in events that are reported in some of the periodicals that many of us read. It has been reported that some district presidents have done some of these things, and perhaps they have. I would think that whoever is president of the Missouri Synod must carry out his responsibilities under the bylaws and the constitutions of the church, and that is to expect all district presidents, all members of the administration of the church, all seminary officials, and all others in positions of responsibility to carry out their responsibilities in keeping with what the church has asked them to do. It is irresponsible for district presidents to disregard the fellowship position of the church, as some are reported to do. And I think it's clear that the president of the synod, according to Article 11 of the Constitution, must admonish, reprove, advise, and try to work with district presidents to have us all exercise a responsible kind of commitment to the policies and actions of our church body. And if it doesn't work, I think finally, when push comes to shove, such persons ought not be holding the office of district president, and it may actually be the task of the next president of the synod to enforce a kind of discipline over against such officials who will not carry out the provisions of the synod. Explain what funding comes to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Comes from Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to the Lutheran Family and Children's Services. Will this stop if we adopt the resolution to discontinue fellowship? Looks like there's two parts to it. I'm not very familiar with the operation of Lutheran Family and Children's Services. Is anybody here on the staff? Anybody know that operation? I know that in the current issue of the Missouri District Voice that comes with the Lutheran Witness, our good president, Dr. Spitz, has an article on Lutheran Family and Children's Services, which I have not read in its entirety. Perhaps something is explained there. I'm sorry, I just don't know. What funding from Missouri Synod to Lutheran Family and Children's Services? My guess is that, if I were to guess, I would say nothing. My second guess would be very little. Because Lutheran Family and Children's Services is not, per se, a synodically owned and operated agency. It is a local agency, and it may get some funding directly from Synod, but I think it's more likely that its funding comes from our congregations more or less directly. Does anybody know? Anybody have accurate information? I really don't know the budget of that organization. But perhaps the real question there is, will this stop if we adopt a resolution to discontinue fellowship? I don't know quite what the this is that would have to stop. I would think if we discontinue fellowship, and maybe Sam would like to comment, I would like to think that, I mean, it's general, this is a general answer, because I don't know this particular situation. I would not think that a resolution to discontinue fellowship would mean that all Lutheran cooperative endeavors must stop. A great deal would depend on what it is. If, for example, Lutherans in different denominations join hands and arms in some agency to provide food for the hungry, clothing for the poor, aid to refugees, programs to provide better educational opportunities to the underprivileged and the like, in which there would be no compromise of biblical doctrine or truth, there would be no reason to discontinue joint Lutheran funding of such programs. We have had that kind of thing throughout the history of our church. And I just don't think that that would happen in that kind of agency. If it's an agency in which the two denominations are together in conducting a campus worship center or a church on a college campus, where the doctrine of the church is involved, I would think there that eventually, and by that I don't mean many years hence, but I mean after a reasonable period of time, that kind of activity should indeed cease if fellowship is discontinued. Sam, do you have any footnote on that?
No, other than that usually most of the agencies were together with the LCA as well as the LC, and this would not be affected by the LC.
Yeah, Sam is pointing out that this kind of local agency is usually tri-Lutheran, that it has, or four-level Lutheran, that it has the LCA involved, and that would probably not be affected by such a resolution. Let me see what the others are.
Sam, I got to find one. Here's one. This must be for you, Sam. Want to come up here? If we stay in fellowship with ALC, what happens if the LCA and AELC join with the ALC? Does this mean we would also be in fellowship with them? P.S. Thanks for a job well done, Sam. So I think you've got it. Why don't you take that one?
Actually, I think Dr. Bowman can answer these questions better than I, sure. But so that we give him a break, this is an easy one to answer. The CDCR has expressly stated what has been the custom, the practice of our synod. If there is a merger between the ALC, LCA, and AELC, we would not be in fellowship with this new church body. The most recent example of this kind of thing taking place was whenever three synods our three church bodies with which our synod was in Tobenalter Fellowship in Germany merged back in the early 70s to form the Selbstständige Evangelische Landeskirche. We then took specific action in a convention resolution to, after had carried on discussions with these people, declare Tobenalter Fellowship with a new church body. So if there should be a merger, this would automatically terminate fellowship with any one of the individual members and replace us with the new church body.
Very good. Why don't you stick around, Sam? If I can get another easy one like that, I'll... Why does the Synod allow some of our congregations to keep Seminex field workers? Sam, this is obviously for you. They teach in the Sunday schools of these churches and spread seeds of doubt among the Sunday school students. Yeah, I don't like that either, congregations that keep Seminex field workers. I guess it would be politically astute to observe that this only happens in St. Louis, but that doesn't get us very far. Technically, the question of what kind of field worker a congregation has is a decision of the congregation. It's not made by the synod. It's not made by the district. It's made by the congregation. And I fear that in many cases it's made by the pastor of the congregation, and sometimes the layman may not even understand that the field worker is from Seminex. In the St. Louis area, we have excellent cooperation from the congregations here in placing our field workers. And we have been very reluctant in times past to place our field workers in a congregation that also has Seminex field workers. But we have made some exceptions to this, where we have been assured that the young man or men will not be heavily involved in a tug of war within the congregation. And we have done this to a large extent because the congregation itself is divided, and having a Concordia Seminary field worker has made our good conservative laity in such congregations feel that they were still part of the Missouri Synod. And I think in some cases, our young men have helped to bring some congregations with more moderate pastors a little bit more back into the fold of the Missouri Synod. But I don't for the life of me know what to advise about congregations with Seminex field workers. It is obviously wrong, and it is contrary to good Missouri Synod practice for Missouri Synod congregations to have seminary students doing field work because the Seminex field workers are members of another denomination. It is nothing different in principle from having an LCA field worker or something else. And I think it's strictly wrong. So if you know of such congregations, I would encourage the members of the congregation to bring pressure to bear on the pastor and voters' assembly. Perhaps eventually the circuit counselor and President Spitz himself will have to give advice to those congregations to cut it out. Let's see, Sam, this might be for you too. The Fort Wayne Seminary faculty has submitted an overture to withdraw from fellowship with the ALC at this coming convention. The St. Louis Seminary faculty has remained alarming silent, overture-wise, on this matter. Why hasn't the St. Louis Seminary faculty presented a united front with their brother faculty members at Fort Wayne on this critical issue? The question prejudges the answer. Okay, Why hasn't the St. Louis Seminary faculty presented a united front with their brother faculty members at Fort Wayne on this critical issue? First of all, no one on the Fort Wayne faculty asked us to join hands with them in presenting a united overture. We didn't know they were going to do it. We weren't asked to cooperate, and so on. Secondly, I would observe that four members of this faculty are members of the Commission on Theology and Church Relations and shared in the drafting and adopting of the CTCR resolution that you have just heard, and feel that the Synod itself has placed the responsibility for making recommendations on fellowship squarely into the hands of the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, not into the faculties of its seminaries. Now, this faculty has refrained from telling the Synod what it ought to do. That is, it has refrained from doing that since 1974. Now, prior to 1974, this faculty thought it was leading the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it was forever telling the Synod and its pastors what it ought to do. We have rather steadfastly felt that we will do the most to make this Synod orthodox, conservative, confessional, Missourian, by doing the best possible job we can in the classroom, in working with our young men, in helping shape their convictions for the future. I don't doubt for a moment that if the two seminary faculties had had an opportunity to have a joint meeting, which is very difficult when you're 400 and some miles away, and this subject had come up, that the faculties would have been of one mind on this issue. I know of no member of this faculty who disagrees with the CTCR statement and recommendation on fellowship, and I think I can assure you without any doubt whatsoever that both seminary faculties do in fact agree that fellowship should be terminated. What will happen to the congregations who are now in pulpit and altar fellowship? Sam, why don't you take this one? What will happen to the congregations who are now in pulpit and altar fellowship? I take it that means probably at a local level where two congregations are sharing pulpits and that kind of thing. You maybe comment on those guidelines.
Well, I'm not sure precisely the focus of this question. I think we would have to go back to the 1969 resolution to see what that resolution declared we were in. When we were in the 1969 resolution, when fellowship was declared with the American Lutheran Church, it was stated that this meant basically four things: that now members could commune at the altars of the other churches, that pastors could preach at in the congregations of both churches, that congregations of the two church bodies could hold joint worship services, and that members could be transferred back and forth between the two church bodies, and that with the proper approval of the presidents of the two church bodies, pastors could take calls from one church body to another. If we adopt the CTCR's recommendation that we terminate or that we declare that we are not in altar and pulpit fellowship, it would mean that what was declared in 1969 is now undeclared, if you wanted to use that word, like disappoint and appoint. We would not be in that kind of relationship. Now, there may be some special situations that would take some special care if this resolution is adopted. For example, in one of our districts, Northern Minnesota District, for example, back up in that country where congregations are spread out over a great deal of distance and where there are a lot of ALC people, there are some Missouri Synod congregations being served by ALC pastors. This is one of the questions that this special fellowship committee that Dr. Price has appointed, with which I work, is going to be preparing some guidelines to offer to the Synod as to how we might handle situations like that. There may be cases where we could not, right at the moment that resolution was adopted, disengage ourselves from all the activities that we're involved with. Another kind of situation would be some of the joint school situations, where these matters will have to be handled sensitively and pastorally and evangelically. But by and large, the effect of this resolution would mean that the things that were declared in 1969 would no longer be permissible.
Sam, there's another one here. Dr. Nasker, upon the adoption of the CTCR recommendation to end fellowship with the ALC, does the commission expect a significant amount of defection or rebellion on the part of LCMS congregations and their members?
Good good to have you up here.
Well, the commission lives out in the church, and we're well aware of the fact that, as I indicated earlier, there are a lot of people in the Synod who disagree with the CTCR's recommendations. I myself have spent most of my time in recent months in districts like that. In fact, it's a unique experience for me to be in a group here tonight where I have a feeling that I'm among people who may be somewhat supportive of the CTCR recommendation. I've been in groups where it would be hard-pressed to find even one person who thought that this was halfway a good idea that the CTCR had come up with. There will be people who will, if this resolution is adopted, will disregard it. In fact, I told the pastors in the Southern District last week, I fully suspect that if the Synod adopts the CTCR recommendation, probably the first month after the resolution has been adopted, declaring that we're no longer in pulpit altar fellowship with the ALC, we'll have more ALC pastors in Missouri Synod pulpits than at any time since 1969. But the fact of the matter is, right now, we do not have a significant exchange of pulpits in any of the parts of the country with the ALC. There is not a real active altar of pulpit fellowship with the American Lutheran Church today. Last fall, whenever I was speaking into a number of districts, all the way from South Wisconsin to Texas to Ontario to New Jersey, I asked the question, how many of the pastors in this conference have had an ALC man in their pulpit within the past 12 months? And I don't recall in a single occasion where more than 10% of the hands went up. There is not a lot of exchange going on. I suspect that a lot of people will feel they have to declare their independence and do something to show that they are in control if this resolution is adopted. I myself, and Dr. Bowman can answer this question for himself, and the commission hasn't specifically asked this question, if this resolution is adopted, I do not look for any large-scale defection. There may be a few, but I think most of the people who are going to leave the Synod have left it, and those who now would dislike this resolution probably will feel somewhat estranged, a little bit more estranged from the Synod than they do now, but I don't look for many people to leave.
I want to thank all of you for being with us here this evening, and in closing, if you will turn to the back of your program, you can join together in the singing of I Know That My Redeemer Lives, and then close with the benediction. I know that my Redeemer lives. What comfort this sweet sentence gives. He lives who once was dead. He lives my the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the communion of the Holy Ghost be and abide with us all. Amen. Good night.